So I started working with kids before I was a parent, and then had kids and realized how hard I was on the parents I'd worked with to that point and how little I knew. But the Lord has really taught me a lot through working with families and having my own family. And this is a really dear topic to me because our world as a family has been touched immeasurably by adoption. So my husband, Chad, was adopted at birth. And when we met and married, he was really intent on that one day we would adopt a child. And I don't have strong opinions about many things. So I was like, that sounds good. I'm a follower. So we had two kids biologically. And then in 2016, we adopted our third child. So many of you get to fill out incident reports on him frequently. So I just want to say thank you. And I should be handing out cash later. So he's a bit of a biter. It's okay. He'll work through it. Okay. So I want to set the stage theologically for adoption and adoption and foster care. And so the obvious theological segue is that we are all adopted into God's family if you believe that Christ died for your sins. I think the less obvious theological point about adoption is that adoption and foster care is a result of the fall. And so that kind of is a hard thing to hear a lot of times of, we really wouldn't have to have this if Adam and Eve had never sinned. And so even in the best case scenario, so let's say that Chad and I go on a date tonight and we're in a wreck and we both die. So at that point, the people we've appointed to be our children's guardians are gonna need to step up. And they'll either adopt them or they will foster them. Either way, they're gonna step up and take care of our kids. So even though we didn't do anything to lose those children in our lives, we would not have died if it weren't for sin entering the world. And so adoption and foster care is always plan B, okay? And that's hard for people to hear. And it doesn't mean that God doesn't have absolute sovereignty over the process and his hand in every adoption and foster care story. But I am plan B for baby Webb because his mom and dad couldn't fulfill their need as a parent. And it's because of sin, and maybe not necessarily their intentional, volitional sin, but people have sinned against them and caused them to not be able to fulfill that role. Wherever sin goes, grief always follows. So sin always causes us to lose something, and therefore if something is lost, you must grieve it. And so sin and foster care is always a grief-producing experience. And that gets pretty touchy because if you really love a child and you've welcomed them into your home and you've made them your own and you've given them everything that you can, to hear them say, I really wish I could be with my birth parents, really stings. But that's part of the grief process, that it's not fair that they didn't get to stay within their birth family. Even though their adopted or foster family is a great choice for them, it's just not right. It's not as it should be. The earth groans under the weight of sin. And this is a result of that. I think of adoption and foster care as the groaning of creation because we are not as we ought to be. One day we will be. So that is kind of the foundation as we move forward. So there's a couple of different paths to adoption. So infant adoption, when a baby is born and in the state of Texas, you have to wait 48 hours before the birth mom can relinquish rights, but a pretty quick segue into a forever family. There's foster to adopt, so a child being removed from their birth family and placed into an alternative family environment. And sometimes with foster to adopt, there's multiple stop points until a child gets to their forever family, or there may not ever be a forever family for that kid. So statistically, if a child reaches adolescence and they've not been placed in a forever family, they're probably not gonna make it to one. They're gonna age out of the system. So I am just here to encourage you today. Happy Thursday. Yeah, hope you didn't come in too depressed because I'm gonna tank you. Okay, I'll get to some hopeful stuff later. And then obviously foster care. There are some people that have felt the call to foster kids, not with the intention of adopting, but to love them for that season until they move on to another placement, which is such a high calling and so hard to do. If you're going to love that kid, you're welcoming grief even more into your home because they're going to leave at some point. Okay? So there's multiple pathways. So setting the stage, and for some of you, this is going to be a review, but one of my most favorite subjects to read about and to talk about and to teach my students about is about neurobiology and attachment. So I tend to see all things through the lens of attachment. They have a mommy wound. They have a daddy wound. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. So with the brain, at birth, a child is born with about 100 billion brain cells or 100 billion neurons. Neurons, brain cells, same thing. And what's going to happen is from the third trimester on in utero, the brain is going to start collecting experiences and writing what we call implicit memory. Implicit memory is unconscious recollection. So unconscious recollection or implicit memory is where your body keeps up with the memory, but you don't have a conscious cognitive thought of it. But the body never, ever, ever, ever forgets. It keeps everything stored for us, okay? So from the third trimester on. So that's important because many times we think that if a person is adopted at birth, they will not have any trauma. That is not true. Because from the third trimester on, they were in a different belly, and that belly may have had some different experiences. So our little guy had a pretty tough belly experience. And we joke about it because it's joke or cry. But at a certain point in the third trimester, my son's birth father was shot in front of birth mom. Don't worry, just a flesh wound. Well, a couple of flesh wounds, but he lived. But that was really traumatic, and she was part of all of that. She witnessed all of that. If nothing else, the cortisol level in her abdomen skyrocketed, which cortisol is the stress hormone. In short increments, it's really helpful. In prolonged increments, it's really detrimental to cells and to the body as a whole. Okay? So even in just small, in 10 weeks, a baby can experience enough trauma to be lasting and impactful, even if they're not outside the womb yet. Okay? So at the third trimester, the brain's going to start writing these memories. And every time a person has an experience, it's going to have an equal brain reaction. And a brain reaction will be where the neurons fire or they talk to each other. And they follow this thing called Hebb's axiom. Hebb's axiom means that neurons that fire together are statistically more likely to wire together. So what that means is if you have one experience and it's coupled with another experience, if you do that over and over and over again, you're going to be more likely to have that same exact experience. So let's just say that every time, let's just pick potty training, because that is the life stage from hell, literally. my least favorite. So let's say every time my kid has an accident, hypothetically, of course, because I'm a professional. But every time my kid has an accident, I do something like, what is wrong with you? Are you kidding me? We talked about this. You're three. You should be over this by now. What kind of feeling do you think that's going to bring for the kid? Negative, definitely. Shame. And shame is, I am bad. Guilt is, I did something bad. Shame is, I am bad. And so what's going to happen is if I do that enough to my kid, then that experience of shame is going to get coupled with the experience of having an accident. Now, if I do it enough, I don't even have to be present in the future for the kid to have that shame response. He'll do it to himself, or she'll do it to themselves. God, I'm such an idiot. I should know better. And so that's what the brain does with Hebb's axiom, okay? And what tends to happen is we gather up these experiences and they get joined together in what's called a neural net. And a neural net is when you have multiple stimuli that all get tied together so that in the future they're so tied together you just have to have one part of the experience to pull the whole net down. Okay, so a more positive example, think about Lovies. So pacifiers, blankets, these little thingies. If a kid, well, what do you do with a little bitty kid who's upset and maybe they take a pacifier, they have a lovey, or they have a blanket? You give them to them, you wrap them up, and you hold them close, okay? So what happens is if the main caregiver does that repeatedly, that's gonna create a neural net. And the neural net is gonna be for comfort and for safety. Now, the caregiver can do that enough that the child doesn't have to have the caregiver present any longer. If that attachment object or that lovey is present, that'll pull down the whole neural net for comfort. So our oldest is a blanket kid. So is our youngest. They are like blanket people. They don't go anywhere without their blanket in the house because it's not socially appropriate for them to carry them outside the house now. But so when our youngest started preschool, she would come home with these drawings and I'd be like, oh, tell me about what you created. And she's like, well, that's BB. Oh, tell me more about BB. BB's the blanket. I was sad today at school, and so I drew BB. She's pulling down the BB neurological net for comfort, okay? So that's how neural nets work. They can be positive, they can be negative. The brain is always values neutral. So it just collects the experiences. It doesn't say, this is a shameful experience. We're not gonna write this. We're just gonna ignore it. It'll just write everything, okay? So with Hebb's axiom and neurons in the brain, the right side of the brain is responsible for certain things and the left side of the brain is responsible for things. The right side is responsible for everything that's nonverbal, for your sensations, for your experiences. When you walk into a room and you have a sense that something's not right, that's your right brain at its finest. The left side of your brain is responsible for anything linear, logical, language, anything that starts with an L, and anything that fits nicely within a box, okay? The left side of the brain is not gonna fully come online until about 2. What do most kids who are developing most averagely start to do around 2? Talk, yes. Some are like radios. You turn them on and you can't ever turn them off. It's like a broken radio. So that shows us neurologically they're progressing and the left side of their brain is online. So the right side of the brain is online from the third trimester on, and it's gonna take in all of the nonverbals, all of the stimulation, all of it through senses, and it's gonna write that data and remember. And so everything that starts happening third trimester on, the right side of the brain is taking in, categorizing, and remembering in the body, but not consciously in recollection, okay? You still tracking with me? Okay, so with that, if you have good experiences, your brain is gonna remember good experiences. Your body is gonna remember good experiences, okay? So if you're in a home that is safe and that is loving and that is moderately stable, then your brain is going to write most of that data to have the expectation that your needs are gonna be met in an appropriate way and the world around you is safe. So a baby is always asking the question, is my world safe and are my needs going to be met? Okay. So if you have a kid that grows up in a moderately stable home, the answer is yes. And attachment, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, to do it well is good enough most of the time. So that's about 30 to 50%. So if a parent can be subpar to mediocre, they're gonna nail this attachment thing. But homes where children are going to be removed by CPS and go into foster care don't fit into that category, okay? So with children who are in foster care, you don't just get removed and put into foster care just because. You gotta do some pretty bad things to go to foster care. And so all of this data that a child's brain is writing is pretty negative. Okay. And what it's building is the expectation that the world is not safe and my needs will not be met. Okay. So with that, so about 2, the brain is going to start writing explicit memory, and that's conscious recollection. So about 2, the brain left side is going to kind of come online and you will start to have memories, but they'll be spotty until about 5, even for a non-traumatic brain. Or a non-trauma brain. So children have this thing called natural childhood amnesia where they cross wires. So when my middle son was, he just turned three, and it was around Easter time, and our children's ministry does an excellent job. And he was like, so Mom, when am I gonna die on the cross like Big Ginger? It's like, We've crossed wires. Okay. First of all, only Jesus died on the cross for your sins. It is highly likely that you will not be crucified in your death. And Big Ginger died of old age, and she definitely did not die for your sins. She taught Sunday school, but cussed a whole lot, so I'm definitely sure she's not Jesus. So he had crossed. In January of that year, my grandmother had died, and it was a good death. She was like 90, a million years old. And so it was a great opportunity to teach them how to grieve, and so we took them to the funeral. So he's crossed Big Ginger, and now it's Easter season, and somebody's dying on the cross for our sins. So he's crossed those wires with Jesus and Big Ginger. That's natural childhood amnesia. Okay, things just get crossed. So that's really normal until about 5 for just average healthy kids. Okay, so with children who are more than likely going to be in some sort of foster or adoption situation, their memories are going to be stored more fragmented. And the reason that is because trauma stores fragmented. So trauma is anything that happens that threatens the safety and the integrity of the person. So it can be physical threat, it can be emotional threat, it can be anything that would threaten that person's safety. And it is always kind of in the eye of the beholder. So something to me could not be traumatic, but something to you could be traumatic. So we can never base trauma off of our personal viewpoint because we look through a different lens. So you can have a kid who's gone through a lot and they don't experience their world as traumatic, whereas you can have a kid that's gone through not as much, but they have a lot of trauma. So it's just complicated in that way. So with that, I just like totally lost my train of thought. Okay, it stores fragmented. So what happens with traumatic memory is that the part of the brain in the left side of the brain called Broca's area is responsible for language. So anytime anyone of any age goes through a traumatic event, that part of the brain shuts off. Like it just goes black. So even if you have explicit memory, your left side of your brain functioning and online, that part of your brain that's responsible for storing speech and generating speech is not doing anything during a traumatic event. So even adults and children who have trauma after 2 won't have words attached to the trauma usually. And the memory stores fragmented, kind of like if you were to break a mirror but the pieces don't fall down and it's broken, so you look in the mirror, the reflection is fragmented. So that's how traumatic memory stores in the brain is fragmented, because we don't have words, we don't have conscious recollection attached to things, okay? Sometimes the brain just completely shuts down. The left side of the brain is like, I'm out, this is way too much work. Right side, take over. And so some people have trauma that they have no memory of it, none whatsoever, regardless of their age. If trauma happens before the age of two, when the left side of the brain comes online, children won't have conscious recollection of it, but their body keeps all of the memories, okay? That makes trauma that much more challenging to deal with and that much more confusing, because when we don't have words to put with something, we can't make meaning out of it. And we were created as meaning-making individuals or as meaning-making cultures. So if you don't have words, that makes it that much more difficult to deal with, because you'll have bodily sensations, you'll have physical reactions, but you don't know why you're doing that. Some of you, this is part of your history, and you go into environments, bless you, and you have an experience and something's welling up within you and you don't know why you're so upset and it's confusing to you. That's an example of that, okay? So now just think about being a little person, a little bitty kid who doesn't have all the resources yet that they need, and they're confused by what's happening within their body, okay? So that's overwhelming. That's a lot to take in. Okay, so with attachment is, we look back into the Genesis narrative. We were created for relationship prior to the fall. It's not that we fell and Adam and Eve messed this all up and God was like, well, great, now you're needy. I guess you'll have to be married. And stop there. Okay. Our need for connection predates sinfulness. And so we have an inexplicable need to be in connection with other people. Okay, so that's what attachment is. Attachment is just the psychological word for the biblical word that's connection, or I created you to be in relationship with one another. And so what attachment is attachment is a special relationship with one or two or three people, and that person is like the child's secure base. It's who they want to go to when they're upset. There's something innate in us that God created us to want to go to that person who is our main caregiver when we're upset, when we're flooded, whatever. As we age and get into adulthood, we still have attachment figures, and usually that's your partner, your spouse, your best friend, your roommate, whoever, okay? So with attachment, based on how the relationship goes, you can end up with either a secure attachment or an insecure attachment. So a secure attachment is when you feel seen, safe, soothed, and secure. So being seen is that people recognize that you have needs. Being soothed is when you have needs or you have problems, you have a need of some sort, someone meets that need, they soothe you. When you're upset, they respond appropriately. Safe is you know that you're not gonna be hurt most of the time. And secure is you can count on that relationship. Okay, so when those are accomplished, and again, that's about 30 to 50% of the time, good enough most of the time, subpart of mediocre, a kid is gonna leave childhood with a secure attachment. Anytime those things don't happen, you have an insecure attachment. And so there's three different subtypes of insecure attachment: avoidant, ambivalent, and disorganized. So avoidant is where you grow up in a house where your main caregivers are just really emotionally devoid, just very stoic, like right is right, wrong is wrong, everything's black and white, everything gets like put in these nice little cognitive boxes. So the kid grows up learning that emotions are not really something that we interact with. They're not reliable, so they don't really have a whole lot of emotional access. Ambivalent is where you have a caregiver who is flooded in their right brain. Emotionally, they are just flooded by their feelings, and they don't know what to do with those feelings. And so the child experiences that is unreliable. I don't know what I'm gonna get from mom or dad, and so I'm anxious, okay? As an adult, the avoidant person or the avoidant secure to insecure attachment, excuse me, is someone who is hard to warm up to. It's like kind of trying to get close to a porcupine. They're a little prickly. The ambivalent is the one that tends to be high jealous, high anxiety. If they call and you don't pick up, they call you 37 times the next 2 minutes. So someone who has a secure attachment on the other end of that is like, we're breaking up right now because I can't deal with your crazy. Okay. Disorganized is something we can't categorize psychologically. And usually high abuse, high drug use, untreated mental illness, those children fall into that category. So the vast majority of children who are in foster care and who are foster to adopt are gonna fall into that category, disorganized, or one of the other two attachment styles. Okay. Because there's always something incredibly bad that happens to remove a child from a home. So what that's gonna do for the kid is it's gonna leave them with very few emotional resources. And the reason that is we learn self-regulation and we learn empathy based on experiences. So the brain is a use-dependent organ. So it has to be used and used correctly to grow appropriately. Kind of like plants. If you don't do what you're supposed to, they're gonna die. If you do, they live. The brain's kind of like that as well. And so because it's use dependent and because it's immature at birth, and I don't mean immature of like, wow, you're so immature, you're so shallow. I mean, it's just not fully formed. It won't finish fully forming until about 25, the brain. So for a child to learn self-regulation and emotional regulation and EQ, EQ is super popular right now, they have to have a parent that teaches that to them and models it in real time. And so a child can't self-regulate on their own. I would say even probably in a good stable home, they're probably not gonna nail this or master it until like late elementary school, okay? Now, some kids are more regulated than others just because of personality, temperament, and style. But what this means is to develop appropriately and be able to self-regulate and self-soothe, you have to have a parent that is able to soothe you appropriately. Because what happens is our brain is made up of mirror neurons. Mirror neurons are brain cells that when you witness someone do an intentional act, your mirror neurons fire for that intentional act. So the way they discovered this was by accident. They do a lot of research on rhesus monkeys because they match us most by their DNA, and it's not appropriate to study humans in that way. It's not appropriate to put them in cages. So they were studying these rhesus monkeys, and the researcher had this monkey like all hooked up to the brain probes, and he wasn't studying him. He was taking a lunch break, and he was eating his lunch, and he noticed the monkey's brain was doing some weird things on the screen. He's like, what is that? And so the monkey's brain for eating, that part of the brain was lighting up and firing. And so what they discovered was every time I witness you do something intentional, that part of my brain fires for that. So that's really powerful in understanding what children witness. So if a kid grows up in a home where they have parents that most of the time can access their adult side of their brain, and if the kid is losing their mind and say, like losing their mind, the parent doesn't dysregulate. They say, I know you're really upset. I'm not for biting. This just rolls off the tongue for me. I know you're really upset, Webb. I'm not for biting. You can choose to sit in my lap and I'll hold you, or you can choose to sit beside me and I'll be with you until you're done being a little whatever. Okay, I leave that part out, but plays in my head. So if that happens repeatedly, his brain cells are firing for that. His mirror neurons are firing for empathy and self-regulation. Okay. Now, what if a person grows up in a home where that never happens? Or what if they grew up in a home before they're removed from that home and they witness tons of violence? Their brain is just taking in all of those experiences. The mirror neurons are activating. Domestic violence is one of the most detrimental experiences for a child to have, even if they're never abused, because their mirror neurons are taking all that in and firing. Okay, so that's best case scenario. All the children who come out of foster care or who are being adopted out of foster care are not having that experience. They're having the opposite. So when kids get into their forever home, they are a train wreck. Okay, so let's talk about the flip side with this. So the reason why people adopt. We always have reasons. Oh, well, let me say this one thing. So we're equipped in our brain with this kind of alarm system. It's called neuroception. And neuroception is the brain's always scanning the environment for threats. And if you are a well-regulated brain and you've not had a lot of trauma, you can be at rest. So I hope most of you all look at rest. Some of you look very restful, but more alert than most of my students. So you're constantly scanning the environment. And what's going to happen is if something threatening happens, like if someone comes in that door, you're going to read my facial cues, which if it looks threatening, I'm going to do something different. Then you're going to do something different. But if we're at rest, we're at rest. What happens with a traumatized brain is it gets stuck in unrest, okay? And that's with the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system. It's like stuck in arousal mode at all times. And when it's stuck in arousal, it can never calm down and actually connect and take in new information. So children who are traumatized generally have learning challenges. And it may not be that they have a diagnosable learning difference, it's just that they can't concentrate long enough to take in any of the information they're receiving because their brain is going nuts with all the stimuli in the classroom. So, I mean, this is important if you're doing student ministries and you have a kid that can't pay attention. Until they have a perceived level of safety, they will not tune into what's going on. So they're not going to nail the Bible stories, not at all, because their brain can't calm down enough to really focus, okay? So that's why the level of low grades, low testing scores is really prevalent with children that have high trauma, okay? So you've got to fix that before you can fix the academic issue. Okay? So the state of the family, why people would adopt. So there are some people who adopt because they feel like the Lord has called them to that, and it is 100% altruistic, maybe like 95% altruistic. What is one of the major reasons that families choose to adopt? Infertility, which is not a bad thing. God puts families together in super unique ways, and he blesses loss in that way. However, a lot of times people haven't grieved their infertility when they go into an adoption placement. And if the adoption placement is challenging, So we've got unresolved grief, and we've got a really challenging kid. So you've got the Bermuda Triangle of parenting right there. Okay. So part of it is parents bring in their own set of issues because of what they've been through to get them to the adoption process. We didn't have infertility issues. We wanted to adopt. However, I still have expectations for how this is going to go. I mean, one expectation is like, don't make me look like an idiot. Okay? Get your stuff together when we go to church, because there's nothing like having a kid have a meltdown and slapping you in front of a client. That's super fun, especially when it's your own kid, hypothetically. Also, we all bring our own past experiences into it. So I'd like to say as adults, we've all done our work, but we're bringing a whole set of baggage into things, even best case scenario where you've done your work. And so because the brain is an anticipation machine, if you get into a situation with a kid that reminds you like of a previous situation you've had that didn't go so well, you're going to anticipate something negative coming out of it, and you're going to respond in kind. And so you've kind of got this wonderful storm that could be brewing. My experience, because I've worked with a lot of adoption and foster care families, is that most of the time parents are not super well prepared for what they're about to enter into. I find that CPS doesn't do a great job of preparing people. And part of it is, well, we don't want to tell them too much because then they won't adopt or foster. Kind of like parenting. If there's things you knew, you'd be like, I choose Tahiti every year, not parenting. So there's a lot there. Also, goodness of fit. Goodness of fit is this term we use when we talk about whether or not the kid's temperament matches the parent's temperament. It has nothing to do with trauma. It just has to do with, do you fit personality-wise with your kid? Some personality types fit much better with other personality types. My oldest and I have a very poor goodness of fit. She is a big challenge. Ironically, she's just like my husband in many ways. Like, this is awesome to see our marital issues play out in my parenting. This is fun. That'll be a good year to two or three in therapy for me. So sometimes it's just a poor fit. It's a kid that you just don't jive with personality-wise. And so you're going to have families that are dealing with that. And one thing I've noticed is there, even if you have a super open, accepting church community, there is something about saying, I really don't like my child, that just doesn't feel super safe here, because it's the church. It's all supposed to be like puppies and rainbows and kittens, right? Most people think that. So there can be poor fit that's going to influence this. Also, if there's existing trauma or existing grief issues for the parents, that's going to get activated very easily with a child who may be difficult, okay? We also have expectations that we come into every situation with, and those expectations a lot of times are not voiced or even consciously known. So I have expectations for my kids. That's why it's so difficult when they don't do what I expect them to do. It's because I didn't expect for you to be that way, or I didn't expect for you to have that challenge. I think I would guess a lot of parents that have special needs children probably feel that a lot of times. No one has a baby generally expecting we're going to have complications or we're going to have challenges. You visualize things, and usually it's pretty happy and pretty sunny. So anytime our expectations aren't met, that is a loss. And any loss creates an opportunity for grief. Okay. So part of it is helping families, I think, name what their expectations were. What did you expect this to be like for you? And it's okay to have those expectations. And it's okay to say, I thought it was going to be like this, and it's not like this. Okay. Usually there's further complications too. So one of the further complications is that healing takes a really long time. So the brain is really plastic, especially in childhood. So I know that if I can have a kid who gets into therapy with me prior to the age of 5, if they've had trauma, they have a much better prognosis of having a quicker recovery process because their brain is still really, really moldable and they haven't been through adolescence, which brings on neurological pruning. But even if I don't get them in my office till their adolescence, there's still great opportunity and great capacity for change. It just takes a really long time. And we're not prepared for that long time. Also, if you're thinking about therapy services, they're really expensive. So families may not be prepared for the cost. For private adoption, put in a pool or get a baby. We got a baby. I really love him. Some days a pool sounds really nice. I really do love him, but it's a safe space. So it takes a long time. Also, the ongoing contact and the relationship with the family. So this can go one of two ways. If you have a placement where it's perhaps an international adoption, so international adoptions tend to just have a big question mark. So anytime there's a question mark, the left side of our brains hate question marks. And what it tends to do is, no problem, I'll fill in those blanks. We tend to fill them in incorrectly sometimes, and that's a problem, but we just don't like dealing with the fact that I don't know. There's just gray in this world. And so for families that have an international adoption and there's huge question marks, the kid could be filling in all kinds of blanks that could be wrong. So part of healing is writing the narrative with the best information that you have. So parents can help their kids write the narrative the best way they can. You guys can facilitate things like that. Have you helped your kid write out their story? Even if there's lots of question marks, sometimes it's helpful even if you help them fill in to the best that you possibly can with the most accurate type information that's not detrimental to the kid. So what I mean by that is some people make up the story in their mind just unconsciously that, well, they didn't want me and I'm not lovable. So maybe kind of switching that of, oh, I think you were wanted. They weren't able, so they chose this for you. But so with international adoption, there's lots of question marks, and that's really tough. With adoption where the parents are still or foster care, the birth parents and the birth family may still be in the picture. That gets very, very sticky and messy and interesting all at the same time. And so how do families navigate that? And a lot of times adoptive families or adoptive parents are placed with the task of deciding, when do you enter into a relationship? When do you exit the relationship? When do you hold back? And if it's a drug or alcohol, result of a drug or alcohol placement, then that's a hard thing for parents to discern. I want them to have a relationship with their birth family, but I don't know if they're gonna be sober this week. Or we had a surprise visit from our birth mom in October and had to say, we don't do surprise visits. I don't do surprise visits for my parents. So it's like, it's not you, it's me. So just things like that that are hard, that are never going to stop generally for families. Also with if a family member or a birth family member might be in jail, do you initiate contact with that? So there's a lot of space for questions and dialogue that I think people don't have good answers for, but even just giving a space to talk about it is really helpful for families and to know they're not alone. And then the marriage. So my favorite myth about marriage is if you have a marriage that's struggling, you should have a baby. It's my favorite one. Now, if you have a struggling marriage and you want to kill it, have a baby. Like, the baby is the bullet that will kill the marriage. What does introducing a child into any marriage situation do? Cause stress. Yes, even in the best of circumstances. You have a healthy kid, average, just an average child. They're gonna create stress on that relationship. With any deviation from average, it's gonna create more stress. So you have a child who is coming in with probably some significant trauma, and they can be wreaking havoc on the family system. Most of the time, parents aren't prepared for this, and their marriage certainly isn't prepared for this. And so I would guess that many of the things that you recommend and you do for families that have children that have physical differences or cognitive differences would be very similar to what you would do with a foster adoption family. So the thing we recommend is Marriage Corps. It's a ministry here at Stonebriar. Marriage counseling, anything that's going to provide an extra level of support to the marriage. So usually when I see families, if it's not trauma that the child has, but it's just run-of-the-mill family stuff and a kid gets referred to me, I can usually trace it back to the marriage. And a lot of times I'm like, hey, don't use your money with me. You guys go see a marriage counselor. Because what's going to happen is everything that happens in the marriage is going to roll downhill to the kids, good or bad. So if you can create some good stuff up here, it's just going to roll downhill to the kids. Okay? So the marriage oftentimes is one of the first places I think to start, because it's kind of like shoring up your first line of defense. Okay? Also, if they can communicate well, which communication is one of the number one reasons people list that they need therapy, is if you can fix that or help with that, then you can create space and skills for them to talk about, well, what are we going to do when she, you know, takes her clothes off at school, or when she acts out sexually on another kid, or when we can't go on vacation and leave them because our family members aren't equipped to provide the care we need for respite. And so if you get a lot of bang for your buck working with the marriage. So how I think you can help, based on what I've shared so far, is one, just kind of understanding trauma. So one of the things I hear a lot from other people and friends, because we've had several friends who have adopted out of foster care in our Stonebriar community, and a lot of times people just want to throw regular old parenting tools at these children. It does not work, because these children are not, they're not starting with what other children are starting with. So I remember there was a family that adopted a sibling group, and it was a drug situation. And so you just kind of have to use your imagination. So what happens at night in homes where the parents use drugs? People are high. Kids are abandoned. Strangers maybe are in the home. So what's that a prime opportunity for the kids? Yeah, or they can do whatever they want to them. So there's a high incidence of abuse that's gonna occur during that time because they're not being looked after. And so I remember this family, the oldest two, the youngest one came out of birth from the hospital, but the oldest two had been in that environment for a couple of years. And at nighttime, when it was time to do bedtime, what do you think happened in their home at bedtime? Oh my gosh, all hell broke loose. And so really well-meaning friends would say, well, I read this book by so-and-so and they said to do this at bedtime. That does not work, because this is not your normal experience. This is not your kid that just doesn't want to go to sleep. This is your kid that is petrified that someone's going to come in and abuse them and take advantage of them. And so part of it is understanding trauma so you don't give suggestions or give recommendations that are really not going to be helpful in that moment. And so in development, if a kid doesn't get something that they need developmentally early on, they've got to have it later to develop optimally. So that kid needs all of that soothing and then some to develop a sense of safety going forward. And so bedtime may be really hard for a long time, that you have to talk through things. You have to make sure lovey's present. Mom and dad have to be there to soothe. We have this thought process in our culture that there's a certain point at which a kid should be able to take care of them, not take care of themselves, but it's especially bad with boys. We're like, don't cry. Get up. You're fine. Now, there is a point where it's like, you're fine. It's okay. Don't make eye contact and they won't cry. But if a kid is really hurt, they need to be soothed. And it will not make them weak and it will not make them a sissy. It will actually strengthen their EQ. And so for kids that come out of these environments, they need an extra, extra dose of that for an extra, extra amount of time, okay? Giving time and space. So that's part of it, is giving time and space that this is gonna take a while. And some of that is, I think, for the families to grieve that this may not look like what they thought it'd look like. This is gonna look pretty hard for a long time. Which, if I imagined, many of you are very accustomed to sitting in that space with families. This is not what I expected. This is not what I envisioned. I need to grieve what I expected to be able to move into what reality is. Resources for counseling. So I hope many of you have good resources for counseling. So with any child that's been abused, they can be seen by the advocacy center in their county. So Dallas County Advocacy Center, Denton County, Collin County, those are great resources. And if they've been removed from their home, more than likely they've maybe received some services already, because usually that's part of the court order that comes down. But they provide free services. So a kid can be in services for a prolonged period of time, because counseling does get really expensive. I mean, the average rate for an individual session in Dallas is about $150. So that's pretty pricey if people don't have an extra $600 lying around in their budget monthly. So that gets a little costly. Also, anytime there's a university that's near. So the University of North Texas, that's where I trained in play therapy. They have two clinics on campus that offer free and reduced therapy. And they need the hours as students, and they will provide, I mean, I had clients that I saw for 60 plus sessions. That's a long therapy experience. And those were my foster care kids that I worked with, okay? Because they needed prolonged care. SMU, their campus up here in Plano, they have a family counseling clinic that offers free and reduced services. So those are great resources. Some people are worried of them because it's students. They actually may be one of the best resources to use because they're getting hands-on supervision on a regular basis. And there's someone that's like attached their license to it and said, I'll have vicarious liability. So if you mess up, I'm on the line. So I know I watch my students like a hawk. So I'm like, I'm not losing my license because you did something dumb. So I highly trust those resources, and they're great resources for families for long term. But especially the advocacy centers, those are great because that's exactly what they're equipped to do, is to offer services for abused and traumatized children. For children that are private adoption, that, you know, you go overseas and you get them, or you get them here, the great resource is the universities because it is lower cost. Empathy. So empathy is where you can sit with someone in a space. I love this definition that Brené Brown uses. Empathy is being able to sit in the darkness with someone without having to turn on the lights. So we tend to be the type of people that we want to silver lining everything, or silver line everything. So when someone comes to us and is like, this is just not going well, we wanted a family and now we have a family, and I think we're going to get a divorce because there's so much stress. Well, at least you have kids. That's not an empathic response. That's sympathy. So sitting in that moment a lot of times is just saying, Brené Brown says, I don't know what to say, but I'm really glad you told me. I appreciate you trusting me. Sometimes I'll reflect back what I hear. It's really hard where you guys are at. This is not what you expected. Okay? So empathy is huge. And then giving space for honesty and vulnerability. So being able to say, this is not what I expected. This is not maybe what I wanted. Or I'm grieving the fact that I wasn't able to get pregnant. Or I'm grieving the fact that we don't have the family I envisioned. Also, and this is the last thing I'll say, and then we'll take questions. So one of my colleagues down at the seminary, she really revolutionized the way I think about this. So she has a story of infertility, and she had lots of babies that she couldn't carry to term to grieve. And then eventually they had an adoption, just kind of fell in their lap. But I remember her saying, I must give space for my daughter to grieve the fact that I'm not her birth mom. And if I get my feathers ruffled because she's sad, because she can't be with her birth family, that doesn't give her the space she needs to live in reality. And I need to have the space to grieve the babies that I lost. And so part of it is creating an atmosphere of, it's okay to say, I really wish I could be with my mom and dad, and not mean your adoptive parents. And kids are strange and amazing all at the same time. They know explicitly what their families can and cannot handle. And they will not go where they know their families cannot handle, because they don't want to hurt them, generally. That's why parents aren't present when we do play therapy. And so kids will hold that back. And so there needs to be space, and maybe that's group for older children, adolescents, to be able to say, man, I'm really sad that this is not what I got. Or I'm really sad that I can't be with them, or I'm missing my mom and dad on Christmas because we would have done this. And for those of us on this side, it's kind of like, how could you miss that? They treated you horribly. But it's a memory for them, and it's important. And so I think giving space for everyone in the process to have an appropriate group and a time to be able to say those hard things can be really, really healing. Okay, we have some time. I'll open up for questions. Yeah, Bruce. Great.
I've got two. One's just more information about pruning.
Yes.
And just what that looks like, plasticity, those types of things involved in that. And
then
the other one is the conflict between, like you mentioned, a lot of counseling.
Mm-hmm.
But in my experience, counseling's always been like, hey, we want to push parents to change more and to be able to adapt, but we can only say so much before we get ourselves fired. And the church is outsourcing so much to counseling that the church is like not equipped at all to help care for a family or a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so when counseling falls apart, the church is just like, sorry,
what do we do?
Fell apart and you dissolved your adoption.
Yeah. Yes. So I'm going to repeat the first one. So more information about pruning and elasticity. So in from about 2 to 4 and then 12 to 14, the brain is going to have an extra large burst of neurological growth. From 2 to 4, the brain's not going to start pruning. It's just going to keep collecting new connections. From 12 to 14, the brain's going to have this big burst of growth where it's like literally reorganizing and organizing itself on a daily basis. But the brain is going to start pruning the neurons that aren't being used. So if, and again, the brain is values neutral. So it's like, ooh, we're not into drugs. We love Jesus. So we're not going to add some manpower to that. We'll put manpower towards the cello. It doesn't do that. It's like whatever you use gets the manpower. Whatever you don't use gets the pruning. And so kids that are having good experiences, they're just going to have more manpower. The brain is actually going to lay down myelination, and it's going to make it about 3,000 times more efficient. So this is why you see kids kind of steadily have this switch in adolescence where they're kind of clumsy, and all of a sudden they're really skilled. You're like, wait, how'd that happen? That happened overnight. So anything that's going before that pruning process will get more efficient after. Anything that's not going is going to be pruned away. It's also why we see major mental illness tend to present in adolescence, is because there's an abundance of neurons before that time. When that pruning occurs, it sometimes reveals anomalies. And so that can be like what's really common to have present in late adolescence is schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. Those are things that don't present later in life. They only present then, generally. And so that can be revealed as well. Okay, the second question was, how can the church help when counseling resources are not adequate because they can't say as much? So my experience has been, short of making really intense value statements about certain things that are very politically based right now, counselors can say a lot. My experience has been parents aren't willing to do what counselors tell them to do. And probably not willing to do what you guys advise as well. That's why I exist, is because parents aren't willing to go into marriage counseling, or they're not willing to work on their own trauma narrative that is impacting how they parent. They're like, just fix my kid. I'm paying you a lot of money. It's like, well, you're a big part of this process. So if it's that and it's the parent's choice, our hands are really tied in what we can do. Then we're providing kind of aftermath care for the family in the aftermath of a failed adoption or of a divorce. I think what's helpful is when I see churches work very collaboratively with counselors and can get on the same page and can, again, kind of have the same general goal. Because I think about what churches offer that I can't is a lot of groups work and how beneficial groups are. So I see you're from Watermark. Watermark has one of the best groups experience for anybody. I send a lot of people there because I know they can get really good care in a group and stay working with an individual therapist. So I think those collaborative relationships are helpful. But short of really making value statements about same-sex issues or abortion type issues, because those are very politically charged, most of the time I find that parents are just unwilling to do what we ask them to do. So, which is very frustrating. Yeah. Great questions. Other questions?
Talking about giving kids time and space to grieve, and also families as well. I was just wondering if you can go into more of the biblical theological dialogue there. So, for instance, do you get into forgiveness, helping kids understand how to forgive their work? I just would love to hear a little bit more about how to tie that back to theology of this, because that's for me. I know I deal with parents.
Yeah, so part of it is, I think, parents being willing to allow the dialogue for kids to be able to say something that profound. Like, I wish I was with my parents, my birth parents. And usually when those statements come out, it's usually in the heat of a discussion, so everybody is not at their finest. I think parents can say things, reflect things back to them of, I know this is really hard that you wish you were with your birth parents. It's not fair that you didn't get to stay with them. And then I think if the dialogue continues, a theological dialogue with that is that always pointing back to the cross of this sin was not ever, God didn't want us to be living in sinfulness. He didn't want us to live in death. And so he's not happy about this. He grieves with us. I think that's a big part of it, is knowing that God is also sad when we're sad about the things that are painful for us and the things that shouldn't be. And so I would go back to that. And I'm always hesitant to say anything about, but one day, because I feel like, but one day is kind of always that silver lining. So if a child is in the midst of sadness, I never go there. I want to sit in the dark with them. I don't want to turn on the lights. But in the moments when they're not sad, I think part of telling the adoption story is weaving in that narrative of, but God always had a plan. Even when things got messed up with sin, God had a plan. When things didn't go the way they could have gone for your birth parents, God had a plan. When things didn't go the way we wanted them to go for us, God had a plan. And his plan is beautiful, even though it's a result of having to fix something that was broken. So I would encourage parents to do that in the story narrative of, and again, some families don't do this well. There was an overarching belief along, when my husband was adopted, that you didn't talk about people being adopted. Secrets are always deadly. We don't keep any secrets. It is always better to talk about it than to have a secret, because secrets communicate there's something wrong, so we can't talk about this. And so I always encourage parents, even if it's the hard truth, let's talk about the hard truth. So my husband's family was a little different in a good way, that they always talked about his adoption story and told his birth story or their gotcha day story. And so they weren't believers, so they didn't talk about this, but you can weave into that of, your birth parents did the best they could with what they had, and they weren't able to parent you. Or maybe your birth parents made some really poor choices and they weren't able to continue parenting you. Kind of like Adam and Eve made some really bad choices, but God had a plan. Does that kind of help? But in the emotions, I never go there. I just sit in the dark. We sit in the dark. We don't turn on the lights.
Can you speak to what if a child is coming from an abusive situation where religion was used as a weapon, but now they're in a home where it's a healthy expression of relationship with Jesus and religion together, but they're still there? What does that look like for the church? How does the church care well for that kid?
I think some of it is helping the parents create a safe dialogue around their faith traditions, that are based on safety. And some of that is giving the freedom that, hey, if it feels really unsafe to go to church today, maybe we stay home. Maybe we take a sabbatical for a season until you're ready to go back to that place. Because that is a very real thing that people are abused within religion, with religion. And so creating safety around that, or maybe talking, anytime a kid is going to go into a situation where they're anxious or nervous or they've had a bad experience, I always like for the family or me as the therapist to help them create a dialogue around it and a plan. Okay, so Sundays, as a family, we go to church. We're going to get up and we're going to do this and then give them safety checkpoints. So I know that our special needs ministry works off of a buddy system. So even a kid like that really could use a buddy. Or maybe mom and dad is buddy for a season and they go to Sunday school class with them and then they enter into a student ministry environment. But it's lots of space, lots of time, lots of control. Trauma always removes control from people. Healing is having control given back to you and feeling empowered.
Mm-hmm. I know this helped. I was thinking of a family the whole time.